Good morning. The 2016 campaign is heating up. How can you better analyze the polls, debates, and mountains of materials heading your way? Contributing editor Neil Milner has a first lesson. On Maui, the foundation that wants to build a homeless campsite has more time to convince the community. We'll hear if that's possible from a member of the opposition, Bill Johnson. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. This morning, we'll look ahead to a 30-year reunion of Topaz, whose members have since gone on to play their music all over the world. We'll talk with founding member and current Santana bassist and musical director Benny Rietveld. And David Krieger, founder and president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, will remind us why tomorrow is an anniversary we can never forget.
It's Wednesday, August 5th. The conversation starts now. Here's the news. Good morning and welcome to a Wednesday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and this is The Conversation. And you, sir, are still Chris Vanderkirk.
Every day. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
It's kind of fun to watch political campaigns at this stage of the game because it's really still kind of the silly season.
Right, and it looks like we're going to have a whole lot of fun starting tomorrow. Let's get started with that conversation. Now, tomorrow, the GOP high-polling A-listers will suit up for debate. Candidates who polled lower will be the warm-up act. The 2016 campaign season is indeed heating up. And these days, you might just want to up your political analyst skills. While you may not become a sought-after pundit, contributing editor Neil Milner says that even if becoming a better informed citizen isn't enough of a reward, better understanding of how your mind works just might be worth the effort. Today, we are, of course, going to be starting with polls. And Neil Milner, welcome.
Good to be here.
So tomorrow we know how this gigantic bunch of candidates were chosen to be either in the A or B list, and that was based on polls. But even some of these pollsters don't like that fact and are criticizing the methodology. So what about the rest of us as we look at these polls?
Well, you have to remember at this stage, and a lot of research shows this, is that the polls at this stage, candidate polls, are notoriously unpredictable. That the best thing to do at this stage in regard to polls is to understand their limits rather than to see them as great insights. A much better predictor at this stage, if you want to watch something, if you want to do your own political analysis, what you should watch is who the party big shots are supporting. That's generally the best sign of who gets the nomination ultimately. Now, at this stage, what's different this time maybe is the fact that there is so much so-called dark money. The way the laws work or don't work now is that you can give an enormous amount of money in a way that, if not directly to the candidate, is in support of the candidate, and you can keep that anonymously. That may change this pattern, and a lot of the big shots are holding back, the party big shots, but you got to remember that the polls don't show very much. And Fox used that polling system as a means of having some way to sort the candidates. Otherwise, it would be like a telethon. If you brought all of them in there, they'd go on forever.
And they did average those polls.
They did average, yeah. And that's the other thing about polls that you should pay attention to is that if you want to watch them, watch them collectively, not individually. That is the best way to look at polls. And remember, that's within the limits. The best way to look at these candidate polls is to look at places that average out a bunch of polls and that don't take the outliers, the exception, too seriously. Real Clear Politics does that. Huffington Post does that. So again, they don't tell you much, but that's a better way. So Fox is a good example, right? So they had to figure out some way to do this. So they averaged the polls together. Given the low bar that I'm setting here for what the polls tell you, that was as good a sorting mechanism. You're not going to use junk and poll. And so that seemed to be the way to do it.
When it comes to local races, though, we don't really have that luxury of being able to average a great many polls.
That's right. Maybe as time goes on, we'll talk about that. I've talked about that before. There are very few polls here. Once Civil Beat came online, there were more polls. But it's very hard here to do any kind of averaging or long-term sorts of looking at polls over time because we don't have enough of them.
Okay, so that's sort of a primer in looking at polls and how to judge them. But what about when you look at this and are trying to figure out something about yourself as you're looking at polls?
Well, that's the thing. This is about something we've discussed on this show before and is very important. Remember, if you're trying to figure out what's going on, you're not generally objective. Generally, what people do, especially people who are very interested in politics, because they tend to be the most partisan, is to look for information that reinforces their own values. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not talking about criticizing it, but if you really want to have a sense of what's going on, you have to take a step back and at least realize that the case. Look at what your biases are. And I think another one here that's important is to understand how much noise there is out there about politics. Noise in the sense of the general use of the word, how much stuff goes on there. But you also have to understand noise in a statistical sense. Statistical noise means stuff that interferes with understanding what's really going on. I guess that's a good way of saying
it. So this is more than just chatter.
This is more than just chatter. But remember that it is possible to get too much information. There is so much gossip, so much discussion, so much opinionating going on that you have to take a step back and saying, is this helping me or is it not? Is this just simple gossip? Is this simple storytelling and narrative? And I think that's another factor that you want to consider.
So should people even bother to pay attention to polls right now?
Well, telling people not to pay attention to polls is like telling people not to pay attention, you know, some people not to pay attention to ice cream when it's in front of them. I guess what I'm saying is you pay attention to polls, but you understand the limitations. They're not telling you much. At this stage, there are better places to look. If you want to pay attention to the polls, understand those limits. Understand that usually the top four people in polls at this stage, one of those four will get the nomination, and outliers in polls never get the nomination. But that's just a small part of the rhythm of a political campaign, which is very different from looking at any poll over time. So lots of people like to look at polls because they're fun. And like any other kind of fun, it's fun. But don't take it too seriously. Understand the limits and understand why you may think it's fun. And that's often because it reinforces what you want to believe.
There also seems to be a caveat in what you've just said when somebody else quotes a poll in perhaps their own campaign material.
Don't ever pay attention to how people quote a poll in their own campaign material, for them, against them. You can check out the sources. And again, there are good sources that talk about polls in objective sorts of ways. The Washington Post Monkey Cage, 538.com. These, and they do it in good, standard, plain, easy to understand English.
All right, so to wrap up this lesson, Dr. Milner, your best advice?
My best advice is be skeptical, be aware of your own biases, and understand that at this stage of the game, a lot of this stuff is just pretty much noise. That a campaign is, even for the nomination, is a long period of time with a certain kind of rhythm to it. And this is just a very small part of it. So watch Fox tonight if you want, but understand the limits of what's going to come out
tomorrow
of
it. Tomorrow night. We're not to Thursday.
That's
yet.
Right.
I know
I'm
you're
sorry.
On Thursday in your head, but yes. Okay, tomorrow night. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Contributing editor Neil Milner looks at the social science that relates to politics and public policy. He'll be back in a couple of weeks with another installment of The Long View.
And this is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13. Later in the show, revisiting the days when the music known as fusion was just beginning to spark. But first, your quiz.
Unihua, Ulehua, Unihau, Ukawa, Oahu, Umulokai, Ulana, Umau, Ukaholabe, Ohavai.
In today's backyard quiz, we're remembering a Waikiki club that was a fixture of the local nightlife scene for 25 years. That's a long time in the ever-changing world of entertainment, but the venue we have in mind stayed on the cutting edge of musical and fashion trends. When new wave rock and roll ruled the roost, bands like Squids and Sonia and the Revolution were regulars on the bandstand. When reggae and Jawaiian came along, the club was right there with them. Its slogan, On the Edge of Waikiki, was more than just a geographic reference. The club opened in November 1980 in a building that had previously housed a series of nightclubs, including the Dragon Lady, the Royal Lay, Fast Eddie's, and Lava Lava. It's probably best remembered by the distinctive mural on its outer wall. Today we're looking for its name, and we'll be back with it in half an hour. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first fast fingers with the right answer gets the HPR t-shirt.
صباح الخير. I am Hakim Belabbes. I'm a Chicago Moroccan filmmaker, and you're listening to the conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Benny Rietveld is a bassist whose musical journey takes him around the world as musical director for Santana, benefiting from the mentoring that goes back to his days in Hawaii as an up-and-coming young jazz musician, and to the band he and his friends formed more than 30 years ago, Topaz. Then, as now, his members are versatile and accomplished musicians. Now they have the opportunity to learn how 30 years of performing have changed them as they prepare a weekend reunion concert. Benny's with us in our studio. And he's very disappointed because he didn't get in time to win the backyard quiz, right?
Did he answer?
I think somebody was there just before you, but...
Ah! Can I say it on the air just to ruin everything?
No, you can't because they're...
All right.
But we'll try to get past the bitterness of disappointment.
I know. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Benny. Thanks for coming in. I was thinking about the whole idea of mentoring, of which you were a great beneficiary back when you were coming up, right?
For sure.
And how the whole tradition of jazz was very much an oral tradition of mentoring until jazz education came around maybe 30, 40 years ago. But it's a different way to learn, and in a way, I think you're kind of part of that last generation to get a benefit of that real one-on-one mentoring.
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
I hope not, but you know what I mean? It's a tradition that was stronger back then, yeah?
Well, only I think it was stronger because literally that's all you had. You
yeah.
Know? So it was like stronger by default. Like both all this other stuff, you know, the online lessons and the DVDs and stuff, they're really great.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a great adjunct to that. And you know, combined with some real mentorship, that can be a powerful learning tool for sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there's no replacing that. I mean, I think because the dawn of the digital age and everyone, you know, thought that, oh, this will replace everything, and it really doesn't, but it's a great help. You know, DVDs, all these cool mm-hmm. things that we have are amazing, little YouTube lessons and stuff. You know, it's a lot of disinformation too, but, you know, there was a lot of disinformation back before that, you know, because there was always that teacher guy that really didn't know what he was talking about was still taking people's money.
and who might be the only game in town.
Exactly. So, you know, there's always disinformation everywhere. But, yeah, there's no replacing real one-on-one kind of an experience kind of a mentorship, you know.
I mean, because when you and the members of the band, you and Noel Okimoto, for example, were playing with Gabe Baltazar when you were kids.
Yep.
And Gabe's a generation older, and he's coming out of bebop and the whole post-war tradition. Mm. So that's an encyclopedia. Yeah.
And it's nothing like you're on a gig and you have this mentor and you're in the trenches and actually playing, and then a couple of words can really sink in because it's right at the right moment. And you're like, oh, you know, like just some guy saying, you know, just play some time, you know, here.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a real, you know, like a visceral kind of lesson that you can read it in a book, you know, play time when the soloist wants, you know.
Oh, but it's, but, yeah.
But, you know, in the heat of the battle and some guy, you know, yells at you or something, say, hey, you know, what are you doing?
Exactly.
You know, you feel it more. And it's, you know, so, it all works really well. But one-on-one mentorship is definitely, you know, a priority, I think.
I was once playing a solo, and I was kind of noodling, skimming the surface, and the horn player turns over to me and says, dig in, Vandercook.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
That was 30 years ago.
Or
I can remember it quite
vividly. Dave Liebman once, we were at the Cavalier, and he was playing, and during your break, he just said, just take your time, you know? That's all he had to say.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh, yeah, you know, instead of playing always on top of the beat or trying to get as many notes in as possible,
yeah.
You know? So things like that are pretty golden, you know, golden nuggets, as it were.
Well, because those get you beyond the specific details that you could very easily get caught up in.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And to very much an overview kind of thing, like
sure.
Relax, these little zen moments.
Yeah, yeah, you know, you can't write that in a textbook, you know. Page 30, relax.
Relax, yeah.
What?
What exactly is that supposed to be?
$40 for this book, but yeah.
But you also have the thing in a club of feeling a reaction coming right back to you.
Yes.
And sensing what an audience is thinking, whether or not they're paying attention.
That's true. And that's really important, too. And even in music that people traditionally think of as not audience-oriented, you know, mm-hmm. like jazz, you know, well, you know, we're just playing our thing, man. But, you know, no, but it's all music has to touch you. Somehow, you know, or take you on some journey or move you in some way. Otherwise, it's just not any good, you know. So whether they're just dancing crazy, acting crazy, or listening and being transported somewhere, it has to reach that audience. I mean, otherwise, just play in your room and forget it. You know. So, yeah, there is a definite audience reaction, and that's why live music is still so cool. Because there's that energy exchange, you know, that's what it is. It's a communal experience, you know. You don't have players without listeners. You don't have listeners without players.
You were saying that you feel as if the pendulum is swinging back toward an appreciation of being in the presence of somebody who's making it up right there.
I really do see that. I mean, people realize, whether or not consciously or unconsciously, but they realize that there's a feeling that you get when there's a band or a guy really playing and mm-hmm. putting it out there that you don't get from even the most high-res TV and the most surround system possible. You know, it's still a recorded performance of another time, mm-hmm. and you're not really there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though the ads will say, you know, like, you know, it makes you feel like you're there, you know, sort of, but not really. The real thing is the sweat and the instant energy thing, and, you know, it sounds all gobbledygook, but it's very true.
Well, you know when somebody's up there burning, and certainly playing with Carlos Santana, it's his quest to get there every time he gets on the bandstand.
Every time.
He's a communicator.
Yeah.
And that's really, and it can be a communication of something simple. If it gets across, it gets across.
Yeah, and you see it, and we look for that, actually. We literally look for the people that are completely losing their mind and just being like, wow, I can do this. I can just let go for an hour or two, you know, mm-hmm. instead of, you know, worrying about this and that and the other thing. And we look for that, and it's the best thing ever. And then we know, okay, the more people that are doing that, the better we're doing our job, basically.
Because you need to complete a kind of feedback loop.
Feedback loop, exactly. Yeah, that's what it is. And it has to be there. Otherwise, you know, it's, to me, anyway, it's just not music. Oops.
That was music. See, we, you know, nothing.
We had a reaction.
We had a reaction, exactly.
We were like, God, doesn't that lady know how to turn off her phone?
Well, Benny, you've learned a lot, obviously, since you and the members of Topaz created this music, as has everyone else in the band.
Yeah.
What kind of lessons do you think those 30 years have brought about?
I think a lot of them are the same, but they just get reinforced. more, like taking your time. I mean, so, yeah, he told me that 30-some-odd years ago, but but to really implement that in on a day-to-day basis is really very difficult, you know. Also, I think the big lessons are the presence of mind when, you know, when everything is starting to fall apart, you know. If you could just know where you are, mm-hmm. what, you know, it's... It really helps, especially as a bass player, a rhythm section player. You have to be, you know, there because people are really, really, really relying on you. It's like you're kind of like the pilot or something.
Yeah.
Just being really, really present and very, very open to every single thing that's happening, not only on stage but off of stage. You know, like just sort of like opening every portal and just seeing everything, like, you know, listening to the drummer, I'm seeing this person dancing as like, oh, this person is bored, you know, like I'm hearing Carlos doing this other guitar, like it means he wants to go to a different section altogether. And then I have to kind of, you know, think about the keyboard player and, you know, like trying to, maybe we're doing a song he doesn't know. So, you know, you got to try to direct him, you know, like, oh, it's this chord, that mm-hmm. chord, you know, so just being, you know, open to everything all the time.
and at that, in those times, you're fully alive, aren't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh,
that's
great.
That's what keeps us coming back.
Nothing like it. Nothing like pure music energy. It's the best thing in the world.
That it is. Great to talk to you, Benny. Thanks so much for coming
great
in.
Great to be here.
Benny Rietveld is Carlos Santana's musical director and bassist. He'll be reuniting with the other founding members of Topaz, Noel Okimoto, Carl Wakelin, Alan Wan, and Fred Schroeders, this Friday at Crossroads Hawaii in Honolulu. And you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Walking the talk about sex without having to walk the swanky runway.
Our focus is totally on women taking responsibility for finding out what they like and then building the skills to ask for what they want.
A new magazine about women and sexuality that is galaxies away from Cosmo's What Do Men Want vibe. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
V is for vision. Listeners who've chosen to name HPR as a beneficiary in their will or trust demonstrate that they share HPR's vision for building community. To those who've joined our Legacy Society, thank you for your foresight. And thanks to these new station members, Margaret Murchison of Honolulu, Lester and Rowan Chu of Kailua, and Rufina Kula of Highland Village, Texas. So let us tell you more about our Legacy Society or station membership when you call 955-8821 during business hours.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose Flex Plus MBA program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Hawaii's own Saloon Pilots are an out-of-the-box bluegrass band, and they'll be coming to the Atherton Studio on Saturday, August 15th with new tunes. Don't miss this evening of bluegrass and Americana music with the multi-talented Saloon Pilots, August 15th at 7:30. Go to hprtickets.org or call 955-8821 during HPR's business hours.
Like on by the point of caring, some old bear I'll soon be sharing. I got 1 mile of silver dollars.
A new school year, a same old problem. Hawaii schools, especially those in rural areas, are again starting an instruction year short on teachers. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a familiar reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
I was thinking that we could, you know, run back to last year and replay a conversation we had then or other years, that this seems to be a problem that Hawaii confronts every year without much solution.
Yeah, you can actually go back to more than two decades. Jessica Terrell's reporting discovers, and it's in a number of disciplines. It varies over the years which disciplines, but we're talking special ed, math and science, English and reading, Hawaiian language, vocational and tech classes. Now, there's a lot of reasons, but it really is also part of a national trend, and here's the deal. The problem is young teachers are actually fleeing the profession of education after working only a few years. They're just moving away, finding the work too difficult and finding other opportunities. But here in Hawaii in particular, you mentioned it at the top, it's especially difficult getting teachers to work in remote, rural areas, low-income areas. And so this is a big challenge we've been facing for over 20 years.
Some of the teachers that we've talked to who have been in that cycle have said, you know, it's just too hard to break into some of, you know, what's already been formed by the other teachers, and they don't necessarily exactly feel welcome either.
Yeah, it's a big challenge, and I can tell you the DOE, the schools themselves, are trying different strategies to increase retention and recruiting. One is to maybe come up with alternative ways to get licensing. Another is to increase bonuses for those who are willing to go and work in those hard to staff areas. They're also trying to strengthen, you know, mentoring and support for those teachers as well. But this is a really big, difficult challenge. Let me just give you a sense of the numbers. Just for this school year alone, the one that just started, the DOE had to hire more than 700 new teachers. 231 of those are emergency hires, and still there's at least several hundred vacancies, maybe as high as 800 based on past years.
And in terms of actual retention, we're only having, what, about 60% over a five-year period?
Right. That means the teachers that stay at the same schools, there's a 10% turnover rate every year, teachers either leaving or switching schools. So imagine the frustration to those students who come to depend on their teachers and feel comfortable with them. This is a very serious problem. One other issue, teacher pay, still a very big deal here because of the cost of living here in Hawaii.
So what do you hear from HSTA President Corey Rosenly?
Well, he mentions the teacher pay in particular as being a big deal and says we got to do something about that. And, of course, he just got elected, as you know, new leader there at the HSTA. But here's another solution that came out. We've got to really convince our young people here in Hawaii to be teachers, that it's a noble profession, that it's something that they should consider getting into. And if that could be done, I mean, who better to teach our kids than the kids who grew up here and know what it's like to teach in Hawaii schools. So there's folks trying, but still we're facing this deal. It's a big cost, by the way, between $6 and $13 million a year to deal with this problem.
All right, Chad. Well, I hope that we're not going to have this conversation
next year. Yeah.
We'll see what happens with getting any more teachers in and talk to them up at the U and see what maybe some of their strategies are, too. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports on a whole lot of things for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. Bert's on the line to tell us about soilless farming. This is interesting.
Well, you know, Chris, there's a whole movement to look at creating kind of an environment for sustainable agriculture here in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And this one kind of came to our attention with kind of a new twist, and that's why we're interested in covering it. I mean, not only is the soilless agriculture something that's being looked at, I mean, there's actually a conference coming up, and we'll talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of wondering, like, how big of a movement is this? And associated with this is the idea of something called food metrics, where, you know, I guess different kinds of the sustainability organizations are putting some food metrics on different kinds of foods, and then the idea that you know, how much of this kind of soilless agriculture is needed to create enough of a sort of a resilient food situation here in Hawaii, so that we are less dependent on importing all of our food.
Well, of course, that's especially dramatic issue in Hawaii, but you know, the world's going to be pretty hungry as population expands. So it's also a worldwide need to find other ways to produce it. Yeah?
Right. And you know, and associated with this, and that's why we're kind of covering it from a tech standpoint. I mean, you know, can you create a soilless food arrangement and save on energy? I mean, that's a big question.
Well, we'll get all the answers tonight at 5.
That's right.
All right, Bert. Thanks. That's Bite Marks Cafe tonight at 5 p.m.
Support for The Conversation comes from Matson, proud to help fund construction of the American Cancer Society's Hope Lodge in Hawaii, a place for Hawaii's cancer patients and their caregivers to stay. Learn more about Matson's giving at matson.com.
To build a bridge between a project to help the homeless and a community that opposes it. That's the question the Ho'o Moana Foundation finds itself now pondering. Last week, the Maui Planning Commission deferred action on a privately funded proposal to build an initial 8-site campground in Lahaina. The foundation was given 60 days to engage the community and address the concerns outlined in a petition delivered to the commission. William Johnson is a retired attorney and resident of Pu'umana in Lahaina, and he joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me on your program.
And thank you for making the time. When you look at the petition and all of what it cites, property value issues, sanitation, security, people concerned just that it's not going to be a place where, you know, tourists should see coming into Lahaina, and many more concerns, is it possible for this foundation, you think, to get through all of those objections?
I can't really predict what the Planning Commission on Maui is going to do. I think that they tried this before several years ago in Spreckelsville, and they did not succeed. And I think it's a very ill-advised project. You described it as a program to help the homeless. I think the help that it offers the homeless is quite minimal. All they're offering is campsites on which the homeless can move their tents. They're not offering subsidized housing or housing of any kind or any kind of shelter. They're just offering a flat piece of land on which people can move their tents.
Some might say that's better than having them just squat in various neighborhoods or, you know, out in commercial areas.
I really don't think it is. I think it's a very bad idea, and there are a number of reasons I can go into why this is a very bad idea. The primary problem with this is the site. It'd be one thing if this were located somewhere else that was not so conspicuous, but this site is located adjacent to the two highways that lead into Lahaina, on which 2 million visitors a year travel. So the first impression the visitors will now have who come into Lahaina will be of this homeless encampment. And I think that local government's response recently in Honolulu and on Maui is that homeless encampments and homeless people congregating are detrimental to tourism.
When you look... Go ahead.
If I can... For example, I believe you're in Honolulu. In Honolulu, the mayor and the city council of Honolulu have received numerous complaints from tourists, from hospitality and retail businesses in the tourist trade about the homeless people and the homeless encampments. And so they're going to great lengths to move the homeless people who congregate in Waikiki and camp out in the area away from that area. So they'll have a place to live.
Well, that's already been happening through some of the sweeps in the sit-lie ban, yes. But when you look at the proposal on Maui, which looks a lot different than what people see on Oahu, the fact that there would be these pods or small encampments with a tent, wouldn't that sort of look like any other person camping?
I think it'll look like a refugee camp in Ethiopia. I mean, these are going to be the homeless. I don't think that the foundation is providing the tents. I think the homeless people provide their own tents. And I think it causes the people, the homeless people, to congregate in Lahaina, where the local businesses have had a continuing problem with the homeless people there.
So your basic objection to this is its location.
That's the basic problem. It affects tourism. It's being constructed at the entrance to a high-end subdivision that the founder of the foundation subdivided. So he was paid a lot of money by people who worked hard for high-end housing, multi-acreage lots, multi-million dollar homes. This is going to go in right at the entrance to one of those subdivisions. So it's going to degrade the quality of life for those people. It's going to make a bad impression on tourists who come into Lahaina. It's going to be very visible to each and every tourist, all 2 million of them, 93% of the visitors that come to Maui. All those people are going to have the first impression of their visit to Lahaina being homeless people camping out and congregating in the area. If that were a good idea, then I think we ought to have homeless encampments at the arrival lounges, the arrival gates at the Honolulu Airport, or at the entrance to Disneyland. I think the mayor and the city council have done the right thing. Also, Ellie Cochran is our representative to the Maui County Council, and she's very concerned about the homeless situation on Maui, and she's very concerned about providing low-income housing. 3 years ago, she led an initiative to clear out homeless housing camps surrounding Lahaina, including in this very area where this developer wants to construct a campground for homeless. So it seems a little bit absurd that the county would be removing a homeless camp and this developer would want to replace it with a homeless camp.
Despite the fact that there would be different conditions to this situation than would be with people just squatting in land and putting up their own tents, certainly rules, regulations of no alcohol, no drugs, somebody there 24/7, that's a little bit different than just having an open piece of land where people have come and erected their own tents. Is there any place that you think that where there wouldn't be a sense of NIMBYism that would crop up if this idea were taken to a different location?
I think there are many better suited locations away from tourist areas on Maui. I believe the same developer has a campground in Olawalu, which is a more rural area. It wouldn't be so visible or visible at all to tourists coming into the area. And I think that you're right, the developer would have rules, but for example, it would address alcoholism and drug abuse. But I think the visitors to Lahaina wouldn't really be affected by those rules, and there are adverse effects of those rules. For example, the drug use that some people now engage in their tents won't be allowed in this campground, so it'll be pushed out into the community. And we at Pulumana have a very serious problem in that regard. And let me tell you what it is and why I'm so concerned.
Very briefly, sir, because we have to move on. Go ahead.
Okay. There's a stream that goes through the area that this campground will be at, and homeless people have camped out by that stream and congregated in that area. And whenever it rains in the area, the rainwater carries their belongings. I'm talking about tents, clothing, mattresses, and other things, down the stream and down into Pumana and onto our beach. And included among those belongings are used hypodermic needles containing whatever you can imagine, heroin, other illegal substances, viruses, the AIDS virus, syphilis, herpes. Those are on our beaches, and we are very vigilant about cleaning them up. But it creates a very serious threat to the people on who come to Pumana, live at Pumana, who visit Pumana, and to the public that comes onto our beach.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there for the moment, but thank you for making time for us this morning. William Johnson is a retired attorney from California. He and his wife have a second home in Pomona in Lahaina, and they've had it for 23 years. They now live there 6 months out of the year. And as you heard, he's concerned with the recent proposal to construct the campground for the homeless near the entrance to Lahaina.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the exhibition Auguste Rodin, The Human Experience, Selections from the Iris and B. Gerald Cantor Collections, on view now through January 10th, honolulumuseum.org.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we went looking for the name of a trend-setting nightclub that was a key part of Waikiki's nightclub scene back in the day. It was known for its approach to music and fashion and its reputation for adapting to changing times. It opened in 1980 and shut its doors in 2005, featuring a mix of new wave rock and roll, reggae, techno, and hip-hop in the days when those musical trends were taking over the world. Over the years, it featured bands like George Thorogood and the Destroyer, Bow Wow Wow, the Boomtown Rats, Grace Jones, and Romeo Void, an eclectic mix if there ever was one. If you're of a certain age, you may well have danced the night away at this nightclub on the edge of Waikiki, or you might remember it for its distinctive mural. Of course, we're talking about the Wave Waikiki.
And James Dumas knew that. He called us from Kaimuki, and he'll get the T-shirt. I love it when somebody gets it and calls right afterward. And
we had a regular feeding frenzy, including our guest, Benny Rietveld, who was desperately trying.
Poor Benny. He whipped out his phone, and I told him no. He was not happy with me.
I know.
But if you have a quiz, we'll be very happy with you if you want to send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Seventy years ago tomorrow, on August 6, 1945, a bomb was dropped that terrified the world with deadly capabilities that had been thought unimaginable. Today we share our world with thousands of such weapons and a never-ending anxiety about them. For most of us, that's just too much to contemplate. Others just don't know. Both attitudes are a concern for David Krieger, founder and president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. He's speaking on Maui tomorrow to mark the Hiroshima bomb anniversary, and he's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Chris.
There really was a world before that day and a world after, and they're completely two different worlds, aren't they?
I believe so. The Hiroshima bomb introduced the world to what nuclear weapons were capable of, and of course that's a rather small bomb by today's standards, and at the time there were two of those bombs in the world, and today there are over 15,000 of them.
Any of them with the same capability as the Hiroshima
bomb?
Well,
many with the same capabilities, but many with more powerful capabilities as well.
At least the same capability, yeah.
Right.
Well, where does that leave us?
It leaves us needing to stand up and speak out for the abolition of these weapons requires us to do something that perhaps has never been done before, and that is take a weapon system, make it illegal, ban it, and eliminate it. That's our challenge in the nuclear age.
And rely on our humanity to understand the necessity of that. That's where
absolutely.
That's where it gets tricky, David.
Well, there's so much complacency around the issue of nuclear weapons that's something that requires a lot of education and a lot of advocacy. And our group, the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, is engaged in that advocacy and education every day throughout the year. And there are many other groups, including the Peace Action Group on Maui that work for that end as well.
Well, David, let me just take you back to the time after the bomb when we had the so-called nuclear arms race, based on the notion that if we had weapons more terrifying than anyone else's, that would have a deterrent effect, right? That it was a kind of a balance of power. And there'd been, historically, there'd been a search for an ultimate weapon that would just sort of the doomsday weapon that would just shock the world so much that we abandon the whole notion of that kind of destructive weaponry. Is that a flawed construct?
I think it's a very flawed concept. Nuclear deterrence is based on a psychological or communications theory that if you threaten to do something, someone else won't do something to you that's bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it's entirely psychological. It requires all leaders to be rational at all times, and we know that's not the case. And we certainly know that should terrorists ever get their hands on nuclear weapons, they would not be deterred by threat of retaliation because they have no place to retaliate against, and also terrorists might be suicidal. So
rules of warfare, so-called, don't apply, right?
I'm sorry.
Rules of warfare, as they were previously conceived, don't apply.
You know, it's a very ironic coincidence that we dropped the bomb on Hiroshima on August 6th. We dropped another atomic bomb on Nagasaki on August 9th. And in between those two bombs, the United States signed the charter to hold the leaders of the Nazi and Axis power leaders in World War II to account for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and crimes against peace. And we did hold them to account for those crimes, but we never applied the same rules to ourselves. And certainly using nuclear weapons on civilian targets or on targets that can't be kept from including civilians is a war crime and a crime against humanity. So the legal rules still apply. The International Court of Justice has spoken out on the issue. The legal rules still apply, but they're not being adhered to by the United States and the other 8 nuclear armed countries in the world.
Well, that's an excellent example of history being written by the victors and the rules being made by the victors.
Exactly, but it's not to the advantage of the victors that they haven't applied those rules to themselves. I mean, every day we live with the threat of the possibility of nuclear weapons use, which would be catastrophic and could destroy civilization, if not the human species, and most other complex forms of life. So it's not something people should be complacent about. And actually, a very interesting lawsuit that's going on now has been initiated by the Marshall Islands, very small country, 70,000 people, but they've initiated, and the Marshall Islands was a testing ground for nuclear weapons at the beginning of the nuclear age from 1946 to 1958, the U.S. dropped 67 powerful nuclear weapons in the Marshall Islands.
And got a lot of people's...
The equivalent power of 1.6 Hiroshima bombs daily for 12 years. But the Marshall Islands is suing all of the nuclear-armed countries on the grounds that they're not keeping their obligations under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and customary international law to end the nuclear arms race at an early date and to engage in negotiations in good faith for nuclear disarmament.
Well, any pathway that offers some hope of that is something to keep abreast of. David, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My pleasure. David Krieger is the founder and president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. He'll be speaking at this year's annual Hiroshima-Nagasaki Remembrance Program tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the University of Hawaii Maui College in the Pilina Building Multipurpose Room. The event is free and open to the public, commemorates the 70th anniversary of the atomic bombing of two cities in Japan. The slide talk is called The Nuclear Age at 70, The Human Heart and Nuclear Weapons. And you can learn about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
If you're not yet a member of this station, that little conversation is what we're hoping to start with you. Aloha, this is Beth Ann Kozlovich, executive producer of Talk Shows. We'd like to invite you to become a part of HPR's future by joining our core of sustaining members at $5 a month. This coming Friday, we'll be opening the phone lines. Please take five out of your busy day to call us on $5 Friday. Well, that was a surprise.
We're full of surprises here.
Well, we hope that you will surprise us with your call on Friday for $5 Friday. It's going to be a lot of fun, and you'll hear more about it as we get into Friday. But that's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, a look at primary elections and presidential debates with David Lanui, Dean of Hawaii Pacific University's College of Humanities and Social Science.
And we'll have an opportunity to learn motion picture editing from a master.
We like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217.
And meet you in the morning for more of the conversation.